From Oklahoma to South Carolina, Washington to Florida, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Federal Reserve Board has again cut interest rates and more cuts are expected. For a look at the reasons behind that move, we talk with David Beckwith from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Impeachment fever gripped congressional Democrats this past week. Have they found a storyline to replace Russian collusion? Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The Trump administration is about to conclude a new trade agreement with Japan. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Chad Packard at the R Street Institute. And accusations are flying in Washington as Democrats ratchet up their efforts to impeach President Trump. On his American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says the nation deserves to know the facts. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. In a reversal of policy from a year ago, the Federal Reserve has been cutting interest rates and has signaled more cuts are likely. Here to explain how the Fed works and why it is cutting rates is David Beckwith. David is a senior policy analyst at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. David, welcome to American Radio Journal. David, before we talk about what the Fed has done recently, for those who may not know what the Fed is or what it does, just give us a quick overview as to what the Federal Reserve Board is and what its role is in our economy.
The Federal Reserve's goal is to set monetary policy. It was created by Congress, an act of Congress, 1913, and its goal is to set the monetary conditions for the U.S. economy. In practice, that means adjusting interest rates, the expected path of interest rates. In previous times, it was adjusting the amount of money. But those two things are very closely related. So in general, it's their mission to determine the stance of monetary conditions in the United States. And they've been given some independence to do that. And the reason they've been given the independence is concerns about political meddling. So they're somewhat independent, but they are a creation of Congress. They are very political. But they have more independence than a normal agency would in the U.S. government.
As we look at recent Fed policy, David, they have undertaken a number of cuts in interest rates. How do they go about determining what interest rate levels will be? And then what is the process by which they determine whether they're going to raise or lower those rates?
Well, they have meetings, about six meetings a year, and the committee is called the Federal Open Market Committee. And what they do is they come together and they look at different indicators. And the main ones they look at are the unemployment rate or some measure of how much slack or how much excess capacity there is in the economy. And they often look at it through the lens of the labor market. So can we keep hiring more people? Are we going to at some point hit some kind of bottleneck? And they also look at inflation. So they look at both of those because Congress gave them a mandate by law to have both full employment and price stability. And full employment doesn't mean every person has to be working, but it means every person that can sustainably be employed is employed without overheating the economy. And then the price stability part is we don't want prices to run out of control. And so the Fed looks at those two things. It looks at where inflation is, looks at some measure of the labor market, unemployment, and it decides to adjust based on where it is and where they think it's going to go. And so the last few meetings, the Fed has actually cut interest rates, which is, it's been a big turn. So up until 2018, in the end of last year, they were actually raising rates, and they were thinking they're going to continue to raise rates. But now they've gone down a different path, and they've cut rates. And the reason they've cut rates is they're concerned about inflation going really low, and there's some concern about the global economy slowing down. The concern about the global economy slowing down, that's tied in part to the trade wars that are going on. And there's also just some natural slowdown occurring in Germany, Europe, and then the uncertainty around the trade war itself, as I mentioned. So that's been one thing they've looked at. And then again, traditionally, inflation and unemployment are the main determinants of their policy decisions.
Inflation is running low. Unemployment is at historic lows. So with inflation under control and unemployment at historic lows, wouldn't this normally be a time when we would see them actually raising that rate?
Yes, there is a bit of a puzzle here in that unemployment has gotten really, really low, below 4%, below any kind of traditional marker of where you think the economy is running at full capacity. And inflation is running low, as you mentioned, running below its target. So on that first point about labor markets, there's some debate about whether, well, what is the true threshold where we've reached full employment? And there is increasing debate about that. Now, there's also, let me step back, there's also some debate about whether that's the right way to even look at how we do monetary policy. And I'm sympathetic to a more traditional money view, but I'll put that to the side for now. But if you do look at the indicators the Fed uses, the labor markets, there is some debate as to whether unemployment really is a good indicator and maybe other measures. So make this concrete. Instead of looking at the typical unemployment rate, some people are looking at the employment rate for prime-aged workers, and that measure shows that there's still some excess capacity left. So there's something of an art going on right now where they're trying to figure out what's the right indicator. But by traditional measures, you're absolutely right. You think we would have reached a point where you wouldn't have to cut rates in terms of employment. On the inflation side, I think there's a stronger case to be made for cutting rates, and that inflation is low, which seems like a nice thing, but it also means the Fed's not very credible. If the Fed sets a target and it can't hit its target, and it's not just missing it once or twice, it's missed it for the past decade, then you begin to question whether the Fed's really credible.
One of the roles of the Fed, David, is if we start to head toward a recession, that it is able to cut rates in order to inject some stimulus into the economy. Isn't there a danger that if they cut rates too low here, the next time we hit a recessionary period, they're not going to have the tools necessary to get the economy back on track?
Yes, there is this concern, I think a reasonable one, that the Fed's ammunition, as is typically used, is running low right now. Not much dry powder left, in the sense that they've cut rates. The rates are now between 1.75 and 2, just below 2% where the Fed has its target rate. And typically going into recessions, at least historically on average, they've had to cut rates 5 percentage points. And so we've got about half that much space to work with currently. So that does raise big questions of what's the Fed going to do? The backup plan would be for the Fed to do something like it did in 2008, 2009, do quantitative easing, large-scale asset purchases. The problem with that is the Fed still has a large balance sheet. Moreover, long-term interest rates have been coming down. If we look around the world, you see many places, in fact, where 10-year government bonds are offering negative interest rates in Europe. Ours have not reached that point, but the point is they're getting low, so it's not clear what tools the Fed can use in the next recession. So the second part of your question is, well, shouldn't we keep rates high, you know, have that ammunition ready to go for the next recession? The problem is we tried that from 2015 all the way up to 2018. We were raising interest rates, and last year it began to pull on the economy, tug on the economy in terms of manufacturing, some indicators, things were slowing down. And so the Fed got nervous that they were raising rates too fast. And so now they're going back the other direction. And again, if you look just at the unemployment rate, you might think, well, they could have kept raising rates. And there are other indicators as well. Consumer spending seems strong. But there are other things kind of beneath the radar that do seem to indicate there's some slowdown coming. So maybe the best way to look at this, the Fed is worried about a weakening economy, and they're giving these insurance cuts. But there are real tough questions about what to do if we hit the next recession.
We have been talking with David Beckwith, who is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center, that at George Mason University. David, tell us a bit about Mercatus. Also, where can folks go to read more about this and other topics that you've been writing about?
The Mercatus Center is an academic center that takes scholarly work and applies it to real-world research. My particular group does monetary policy. You can follow me at David Beckwith on Twitter.
David Beckwith, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Of course, we're going to talk about what's happening in Washington this week, because it would appear that impeachment fever has gripped the Democrats in Congress. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman.
Okay, let's take a look at this. Obviously, it's been the topic in Washington, around the country. Those of us who are out in the states are looking at this and saying, are they serious? Are they serious, Scott?
Well, I think that they've been serious about having obstruction of President Trump's policy agenda, of his political operation, of his reelection throughout his entire presidency. From the moment that this president won the election in 2016, they started crying foul. They said that he unfairly won the election by colluding with the Russians. That's been proven to be nonsense. And then after the inauguration, the only real achievements that we were able to get through underneath President Trump were totally red team exercises with the tax reform or any of the deregulatory items that the president was able to get done. So really, when you look at the Democrats, their whole approach in the last 3 years has been, what can we do to weaken President Trump, and how can we impede his chances at reelection? And I think this week is no different. Starting out, you've got these accusations of what President Trump said with the Ukrainians, and then you have presidential frontrunners and non-frontrunners, those that are sort of just in the echo chamber of the presidential debate, calling for the impeachment of President Trump. And they're not even seeing the facts. They haven't read the transcript at that point. And really, it's just a way to tear down the legitimacy of President Trump and his administration.
The fact that all these calls for impeachment went up before any facts were known by anybody, and we're still learning all the facts in the case, this whistleblower, Scott, even failed to have firsthand knowledge of the conversation. So is this sort of echoes of what happened a couple of weeks back with Brett Kavanaugh, where the left took an accusation and ran with it only to find out that it was unfounded and they had scored their political points, so they really didn't care too much about the facts?
Yeah, I think that's a great anecdote. You can also look at the left's treatment of Brett Kavanaugh during his confirmation battle to be a Supreme Court justice. They will stop at nothing to win, even if it means lying, cheating, and stealing. And I think that the Democrats should be ashamed of themselves. We need to let the facts come out. And an impeachment inquiry is, in my view, different than an investigation or oversight, which are key pillars and responsibilities of Article 1 in the legislative branch. So what we need to do is actually have facts. And let's talk about really what an impeachment of President Trump would mean. It would mean that every other item of importance that Capitol Hill should be considering is dead on arrival. It means that we will not have consideration of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, the USMCA, and it means that our appropriations bills will be stalled. It means that there won't be, perhaps for those of us that oppose any further gun control, there won't be any bipartisan agreement on gun control. All these items are dead. The legislative agenda is dead. And what we're looking at right now is full steam ahead for 2020. You can really blame the Democrats for the dysfunction, for the gridlock that Washington has. But Republican House leadership is also slightly to blame, given the fact that we got crushed in the 2018 midterms. And that's what happens when you lose a midterm election. Elections have consequences. And we lost in 2018. Nancy Pelosi got the Speaker's gavel back. And that's why we're seeing just sort of this obsession with impeachment.
So this obsession with impeachment is going to go on, all of which is really not only a highly political exercise, Scott, but a futile exercise, because even if a president is impeached, whether or not to remove the president goes to the Senate, where clearly that isn't going to happen. So this all throws us into the political realm. And part of this latest kerfuffle is the fact that Hunter Biden, the son of Joe Biden, is also tangled up in some at least questionable activities. Does this also put Joe Biden and his front runner status, his campaign for president, at jeopardy?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's actually a real toss-up in the Democratic primary right now. Liz Warren is certainly surging. You've seen her crowd sizes. Size does matter when it comes to the crowds on the campaign trail. And there's, I think, a real enthusiasm from the left behind her message and her campaign. She has certainly been surging in the polls over the last couple of weeks. She's now in the high 20s as Biden is in the mid-20s. He's no longer leading every single poll. So I think his position as front runner is definitely jeopardized. And the continued facts as they unfold here are going to show that Joe Biden actually used his position as vice president to make threats against the Ukrainians to fire this prosecutor that was looking into Hunter Biden's business activities.
Let's look now at what this means for Republicans and Donald Trump. You referenced the fact Republicans lost in 2018. Part of that was the fact there was an energized Democrat base and Republicans were sort of a little bit lackluster in that race. Do you think, Scott, that if House Democrats actually impeach President Trump, isn't that going to light a fire under all those folks who supported Trump because they think the system is corrupt to begin with?
Holy cow, Loman. I honestly think this is going to be probably the highest turnout that we've ever had in a presidential election or any U.S. election. The left is incredibly motivated and enthusiastic about getting out there. I think that there are some Republicans that are still the Bill Kristol, never Trump type, 1 or 2% of the Republican Party, but President Trump's approval rating within the Republican Party is like 96%. He's doing fantastic. And I think that when the Republican voters and independents look at the fact that there is very likely to be another Supreme Court nomination in the next presidential term, if you look at the fact that President Trump has been repeatedly obstructed by the political left at every item that he's tried to move forward, enthusiasm on both sides is just going to be really, really high.
We will keep an eye on all of that with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Sure thing. So the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of our nation's capital. We have over 250,000 members from every state in the union, and our membership is united in economic liberty and freedom. If your listeners are interested in checking us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org, and you can also check us out on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll talk with you next week.
All right. Thank you.
The Trump administration continues to make significant progress on renegotiating trade deals. A new pact with Japan is about complete. For details, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Clark Packard from the R Street Institute. Eric?
The United States and Japan are closing in on signing a new trade deal between the two countries. This is, on one hand, a big success for the Trump administration's trade policies, and on the other, something of a missed opportunity. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Clark Packard. He is a trade policy counsel at the R Street Institute, and he joins us on the phone now from Washington, D.C. to talk about this new trade deal. Clark, thanks for taking some time out of your schedule to be here with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, obviously, Clark, there are some bigger stories involving the Trump administration happening this week. But if you didn't have all that going on, if you swept that aside, I think this would be getting a fair bit of attention. Outside of the rewrite of NAFTA, this is probably the most significant trade deal that the Trump administration has done so far. So let's just start big picture. What's your takeaway here?
I see both pros and cons to the deal. And obviously, I'm waiting to see the text to see what's actually in there. But I do have some preliminary thoughts. On the positive side of the ledger, it's finally some trade liberalization from the Trump administration. Basically, everything else they've done to this point has been to restrict trade, whether that's through tariffs or renegotiating old trade agreements in less than stellar ways. The crux of the deal basically gives U.S. agriculture producers the same sort of access into Japan that they had under the TPP, which is tariff-free trade on about 90% of ag products. It eliminates some tariffs on some industrial goods, which I think is good. I'm probably most excited about the digital trade portion of the agreement, which closely mirrors the USMCA and the TPP, which essentially bars tariffs on digital products like videos, music, video games, software. It provides barrier-free cross-border data transfers and prohibits data localization, which is a tool that countries like India and China use as a protectionist measure. And right now, there are a group of countries at the WTO who are negotiating a digital trade agreement, and there are competing visions for it. So the U.S. has the most permissive position, and then on the other side, again, would be China and India. So the more countries we can bring over to our side, the better. And so I'm glad Japan has sided with us. So those are sort of the high-level things that I think are pretty good about the agreement.
Sure. And before we get into those more negative parts, I do want to ask you about this argument that I hear again and again from the president's defenders. And the argument basically goes something like this. Yes, he's imposing tariffs, and tariffs aren't good, but he's doing it in pursuit of better trade deals, and he's trying to bring countries to the table to negotiate for better trade deals for America, and all of it will be worth it in the long run. Do you think, is this U.S.-Japan deal evidence of that? Do you buy that line of argument from the administration?
No, I don't think so. Hear this all the time, especially some of the more knowledgeable members of the Trump administration say privately, look, he's really a free trader at heart, and all of this is just posturing to eventually get back to negotiating these trade agreements. I think it's time that we take the president at his word. He claims he's a tariff man. I think what this is it's to sort of assuage the concerns of folks in the ag community. Chairman Grassley, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, represents Iowa in the Senate. He's been screaming about the need to open up Asian markets for agriculture products. So this is a sort of a cheap way of doing that. And so I think that this is nothing more than sort of political, but it really is a pretty small scale trade agreement aimed at just two areas, which are agriculture products and digital trade. And so I think, again, it's just a political statement and an achievement. It's not any sort of broad shift in policy.
We're talking with Clark Packard from the R Street Institute about the new U.S.-Japan trade deal that the two countries are closing in on finalizing. Clark, you mentioned this a few minutes ago, but a lot of the details in this deal are essentially copy and pasted out of the TPP. And for people who may not remember, because it feels like it was ages ago, the TPP, that's the Trans-Pacific Partnership, it was a 13-nation trade alliance, if you will, that the Obama administration was trying to put together. Trump pulled America out of the TPP, out of the negotiations for the TPP right after he took office. And in fairness, Hillary Clinton said she opposed the deal during the 2016 campaign as well, even though she had supported it earlier. Now the Trump administration has reached this deal with Japan. It looks a lot like the TPP, but it's only a deal with one country instead of with 13 countries. Is that a fair read on kind of the downside here?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. TPP is still a better deal than this. It encompassed a lot more areas of trade. It had more members to it. It was more expansive, and we wasted a bunch of time and effort getting to this point. I mean, people seem to forget that the TPP, if the United States had moved forward with the TPP, we wouldn't have had to renegotiate the NAFTA. I mean, it was all wrapped up into one agreement because Mexico and Canada were a member of the TPP. It really just would have superseded NAFTA, and we'd be in a much better position right now, especially vis-a-vis China, than we are. So, yeah, that missed opportunity by the Trump administration.
So the bottom line on the U.S.-Japan deal, only about 20 seconds left, so make it quick.
I think it's too early to tell. It's certainly better than the status quo, but not as good as it could have been.
Fair enough. Fair enough. That is Clark Packard from the R Street Institute. Thanks for joining us today, Clark.
Thanks for having me.
And you can find Clark's work online at R Street. That's the letter R and the word street, rstreet.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check us out online at reason.com and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
A lot of misinformation has already been reported in the controversy over President Trump's phone conversation with the president of the Ukraine. On this American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says, we need to know the facts.
The prelude to impeachment, or if you want to put it in football terms, the preseason of impeachment, is over. The formal season itself began last week with the release of the less-than-full transcript of the call between President Trump and President Zelensky of Ukraine, the whistleblower's complaint to the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community, and the decision of Speaker Nancy Pelosi to put her stamp of approval on the impeachment inquiry process. On the other side, there were several Trump tweets, mini press conferences, and countless TV interviews and appearances by the president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani. This issue will dwarf the Russian collusion Mueller report. It will almost certainly define the 2020 elections, not only on the presidential level, but also on the senatorial and congressional levels. It will be quite a ride, unprecedented in both scope and timing, and it will doubtless bring about even more division and heightened emotions within the body politic and the American public at large. How will our country come through it? Donald Trump was correct, probably more so than he thought at the time, when he referred to the swamp in Washington. The swamp is immense. The slithering snakes within it are of both parties, and the media who report on it are heavily biased. However, my irrepressible optimism about America tells me that it can be cathartic, but only if it is unrestrained. Regardless of where each of us may be on the political spectrum, we should all appreciate what a truly historic period we are entering, and we should all endorse the most thorough examination of all charges of wrongdoing by all parties. That would not be possible if the White House and Congress were both in the hands of one party. It is even helpful that the Senate and the House of Representatives have opposing majorities. Get it out. Get it all out, or throw them out, throw them all out. Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska is one of my personal favorites. He is principled, thoughtful, and insightful. He is a true conservative of the sort that we used to see before the blind tribalism into which both parties and both houses of Congress became so intense. What he said last week is right on and should be heralded by all real patriots. It wasn't a particularly bold statement, and yet it was treated as an earthquake. What he said is simply this, quote, "Republicans ought not just circle the wagons to protect Trump," close quote. Someone from the other side of the aisle needs to say something similar, like, "We need to get to the bottom of all this, even if it hurts some Democrats along the way." The memorandum that the White House released concerning the conversation between President Trump and President Zelensky is not a true transcript. What's missing? A Wall Street Journal report prior to the release said that Biden was referenced in it 8 times. Reading the Journal's report closely, it certainly appears to be a claim that there were 8 references to Biden on the 1 July phone call. If so, there's a lot missing. That needs to be thoroughly investigated. Vice President Biden's appearance before the Council on Foreign Relations, in which he talked about exactly what he said and threatened regarding the removal of the Ukrainian prosecutor as a precondition to American aid in the amount of $1 billion, is every bit as wrong as what Trump is alleged to have said to the Ukraine president. In fact, it's clearer. Biden threw the full weight of the Obama presidency behind his threat to withhold the $1 billion, and his boast about having done so meets any definition of improper influence. Subtle forms of such coercion may be commonplace and not necessarily improper, but this was not subtle, and it's clearly wrong. Will this hurt Biden's chances in the 2020 race? That should be a secondary consideration to getting at the truth. And that's just one example of how a thorough examination of all the facts, charges, and suspicions might not come out the way certain parties want. That shouldn't matter to any genuinely patriotic American citizen. It's time to get at the facts, time to dig out the truth, all of it. If we really are the greatest democracy in history, we will not only survive the process, we will come out stronger because we valued our ideals over our political self-interest. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WIOU-AM in Shreveport, Louisiana, WASG-FM in Mobile, Alabama, along with WDZY-AM in Richmond, Virginia. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.